Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
Wow, buddy! You look healthy and happy.
Veterinary surgeon and natural pet food pioneer John Burns knows the positive impact a natural diet has on our beloved pets. That's why he developed Burns Pet Nutrition.
Maybe I should try some of your pet food myself. Okay. I'll start with a salad.
For natural, no nasty, wholesome recipes, choose Burns Pet Nutrition. Available from veterinary clinics and all good pet shops across Ireland.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
We're back on the road this April with our live show, Cocaine Cowboys. If you want to hear the story of Ireland's love affair with Colombian powder and those who made millions in the gold rush, limited availability remains in Belfast at ulsterhall.co.uk. That's ulsterhall.co.uk.
None of us could have done it without each other. The media aspect, the police aspect, and obviously the super sleuth and Sally. It's never been just one person driving this, and we've always remembered that, and we've always, always attributed everything, because obviously when you have something as big as this evolve, it's like that whole success has many fathers, failures and orphans. But the reality is, it's a team effort.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe.
When news editor Alison Sandy began investigating the sinister disappearance of Marion Barter for a podcast series, she did not know where the story would take her. The mother of two had sold her home, quit her job and made plans to move to Europe. But when her family stopped hearing from her, it was soon discovered that she had changed her name. Working with the missing woman's daughter, Sally Layden, and journalist Brian Seymour, the hit Australian podcast, The Lady Vanishes, led to the mysterious case unravelling in real time as a listener found a key piece of information that would blow the case right open. Today, I'm talking to Alison Sandy about the podcast and how the team helped to piece together what really happened to Marion. I'm Chloe Domini, and this is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Alison, your podcast, Lady Vanishes, I have to say, I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts in my job, but rarely is there one that actually sticks with me. And I know this story is one that's going to stay with me probably for the rest of my life. It is such an incredible tale about what happened to Marion Barter. I suppose we'll go back to kind of the start of this one. She's a missing woman. We only very recently, it has come to a conclusion, and her family have been given some closure on this. Well, let's go back to the day she went missing, her last sighting by her daughter, Sally. Can you tell us about that?
Okay, so that was the last sighting. I mean, there was a couple of sightings, but you're talking about the one where she saw her in the car with the
yes.
stranger?
Yes.
The final sighting, but it was one of the last sightings. So basically, Sally, well, first of all, her husband, who was her fiancé at the time, Chris, was packing up the house, helping Marion pack because she was going on this trip of a lifetime and might not come back for a while. And he, all of a sudden, she looked at her watch and says, oh, you've got to go, you know, you just drop what you're doing and go. So that happened first. And Chris told Sally that, oh, wow, your mum was quite, you know, rude or abrupt. I don't know what's going on. Anyway, then they went and had dinner at McDonald's, and they were at the petrol station. Well, they could see the petrol station outside because it was one of those service centre that have everything. And Sally saw her mum putting petrol in the car, and there was a tall, dark stranger in the passenger seat, and Sally kind of said something like sprung, you know, and, you know, waved and everything like that. And her mum looked surprised, shocked, didn't want to engage with her daughter, obviously. She recognised her daughter and Chris, but didn't want to engage, and then got back in the car, went the wrong way through the petrol station. And, yeah, so Sally and Chris were both quite aghast at that. But at the same time, there was this tall, dark man, mystery man, I guess. That's all Sally could really remember. Can't say definitively who it was, but it stayed with her, and her mum didn't want to introduce her to him, evidently.
Yeah, so it was very much an avoidance situation there. Can you tell us then again about this trip that Marion had coming up? Because this is a huge part of what happens to her.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite sudden as well, because she resigned between the school term. Like, the school term hadn't finished, and that, like, teachers never do that. Like, it really leaves their employer in the lurch. So that was quite surprising. And there was two resignation letters. But it was one of those things where, yeah, she was going to start a new life in, you know, overseas. She was going for a trip of a lifetime for a year. That was supposedly, you know, the time frame she would be there. And then maybe, you know, maybe she'd stay. So so that's why she packed up all the stuff, sold a house. She sold a house for a loss as well. She bought it for, I think, 15 grand more than at the time. And yeah, it just ended up being just quite, you know, nobody saw it coming, I guess. And Sally had talked about how her mother, there was a time her mum seemed quite despondent, quite depressed, quite stressed. So she just thought, yep, you need a break, go on, you know, didn't know anything about a man or that there was anything untoward involved in this, I guess, magical trip of a lifetime.
And how old was Sally at the time?
She would have been, it was 1997. She was born in 1974, I think. Well, she's turned 51 next year.
She would have been around 24.
Her and Owen were both adults, so Marion wasn't leaving them in the lurch or anything, and this was a choice that she wanted to make. So there was nothing untoward there. They were just happy for her that she wanted to do this. But I guess the issue is they had so much contact, and Marion did say to Sally that you wouldn't be hearing from me for a little while. But, yeah, after a while she didn't hear anything. And then when Marion didn't ring Owen for his birthday, which was mid-October, that was very suspicious. And then, of course, she rang the bank and they said that money was being drained from her account.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. So Marion had just sold her home. She obviously, like you said, she was a teacher, a very stable, committed job that you have to have. It's not one where you have to stick to those days. You're in work. And again, like you said, if you leave in the middle of term, you're leaving the principal or the rest of the school in the lurch. So tell us about that money. So she had sold her home. She had told her family she was going off on this year-long trip. She had plans, she said, to maybe open a school in the UK. We know she was in the UK, and we can go back and talk a little bit about that. But tell us about the money that was in her account. How much was there and what was happening with it?
Well, there's varying reports as to how much was being taken out in increments, but what Sally was told at the time, or her memory of what she was told at the time, was that it was $5,000 increments. Her money was being drained, which was an awful lot of money, but also that it was in northern New South Wales. And to her knowledge, Marion wasn't in northern New South Wales. And then I think it was about $80,000 in the end was the last amount. And that was about October 15 that was taken from her account. And then there was no record of her doing anything after that. So there is a few days in between her taking the money out, supposing it was her, and Owen's birthday, which I believe was the 18th of October, that something happened to her potentially in that time. So that's the window, I suppose, that everybody, not everybody, but most of us believe resulted in Marion's life ending.
So she went off to, she went to Luxembourg first, was it, when she left Australia?
She went to Luxembourg. It's not clear. I'd have to check that out. But because she went via Heathrow, so she definitely went to the UK first. And then it's possible she went South Korea Airlines. So it's possible that she went to Seoul or South Korean, somewhere in South Korea then. But there's also a contention that she went to Nikko Narita, the hotel, because she had that note paper that she wrote to Sally on shortly after she left. So there is, potentially she did that or she acquired it some other way. And then she went to the UK. During her travels, she sent postcards to a lot of people. So you could see, and I'm sorry I don't have this in front of me, but I'll send you the timeline after so that you can cross-reference. But you can see all the different places where she sent postcards. But one of the things that was interesting was that one of the postcards was sent after she allegedly came back, after she allegedly returned to Australia, which was August 2nd, 1997. This one, I think, was August 7th. Anyway, so there was all this, was it her that came back? But we've seen the incoming and outgoing passenger cards, and the handwriting does look like her handwriting coming in to back to Australia. And people are like, oh, well, could she have, you know, filled it half out beforehand and then it wasn't her. But the interesting thing with that is that on her outgoing passenger card from Australia, which was in July, 22nd of July 1997, it had divorced. And that, she was heading over to, I can't remember where she precisely she said, but on the one back, I remember, this is the one I remember really well, is that she had a big tick in the box, married. And she said that she lived in Luxembourg and that was her house duties, was her occupation. So the thing that was interesting with that is there was, a lot of other women that came forward as a result of our podcast with similar stories of a man, saying a romance scam where they would start a new life in a new country, whatever it may be, whether it be the south of France or whether it be Bali or Australia or, all these different things. And it was the whole thing, again, selling your house, starting a new life. You won't have to work. It just all those lines, I suppose, that Marion's put in her incoming passenger car back to Australia indicates that this was what she believed as well.
And she went out of Australia on as her name, Marion Barter, but she actually came back into the country with a completely different passport. So she had changed her name.
No, actually, she actually went out with Florabella Natalia, Marion Ramekel, and came back. She changed So it wasn't long before it, but she changed her name before she left, and that was the passport she was traveling on.
So the name she changed to was Florabella Natalia Marion Ramekel. So she kind of kept she kept part of her name in there, which I suppose there's always when people, change their names or pretending they've died or whatever it might be, there's always some knuckle of truth in there. And interestingly, we can come back to it, but there was another piece of truth in that name as well that kind of led to, a lot of information coming in about finding perhaps the person who might be responsible for her disappearance. But tell us about, this romance scam that she may have been involved in.
Yes, yes. So Remica was a big clue. And police, New South Wales police, had found that she had changed her name, which was one of the reasons they believed that she went missing of her own volition. So their belief was she wanted to go off the grid and didn't want it to have any contact with her family because she changed her name and didn't tell them and came back to the country and didn't tell them. But the name Florabella Natalia Marion Ramichel, Ramichel was what we went off. So we just kept researching this name, and one of the super sleuths that we call them in as part of the podcast found a an ad by an F.R. Ramichel. So there was no extra names in that, but it was F.R. Ramichel, and it was 1994 in Le Courrier Australien, and it went through, what they were looking for, this sort of romance. So we decided we would try and find F.R. Ramichel, and Brian, who's an investigative reporter also working on this, Brian Seymour, he found the name Fernand, and then the whole idea was we'd take Sally over to where Marion went, UK and Luxembourg, and retrace the steps of Marion with her. And so before then, we hired a private investigator in Luxembourg to help us track down this Fernand Ramichel. So we got Fernand Ramichel. It was the only one in the world that we could find that was age, and it was in Luxembourg. And so that was how we found this man. But it turns out, and we spoke, ironically.
Well, this all plays out through the podcast. That episode where you were speaking to him on the phone, like, really stressed me out. It reminded me of, like, I used to work in a call center, and the kind of the customer service, kind of managing the customer who's really angry and irate, and I just got flashbacks, and that's what it really reminded me of. And I was there annoyed, so I can imagine how you felt. But yeah, this all played out in the podcast. It was incredible.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, I guess just go back one step. That what we started with was nothing. What we started with was the fact that Marion was missing. We knew that we changed her name and things like that, but that was it. The police didn't think she was missing. So everything was piecing it all together from scratch. And most of these things, there was not even acknowledgement a crime had been committed. So we were kind of, as the proverbial, being shoveled uphill trying to get information. So that's what we relied upon, was the worldwide, I guess, tips and information from all over the world, but then did our own research. So, yes, so we found that this Fernand Ramichel existed. We found out where he lived. We got a private investigator because we weren't going all the way over there to come back with nothing, right? You could imagine, would be tearing their hair out. So we had to make sure that he was there, that we would get him. And so when we went over there, Sally went up to the doorstep. We are televisions, so we were filming, but we're all in public. Just trying to get some information. Do you know Marion Ramichel? It was one of those, moments. Anyway, he wasn't happy with this. And at the time, look, there were a lot of cultural sensitivities, which if we had more time, we would have probably been able to deal with it slightly more delicately. But I mean, also it's a very patriarchal society too, so there was just different things that we weren't aware of when we went there. But being in the UK particularly, you'd be aware how aggressive media can be, so we didn't think we were being overly aggressive in the whole scheme of Western media. But in Luxembourg, it was seen as it's very very aggressive. So it turned out that it was the right Fernand Ramichel, in the sense that he was the real Fernand Ramichel, but he had also been a victim of identity fraud, and that someone had actually stolen his identity. And the irony is that we spoke to his ex-wife at the time, his former wife, Monique Cornelius, who talked about this, and she was the link between the two men, the one who stole the identity and the one whose identity had been stolen. So that was fascinating. And she didn't know him. She knew him as Frederick de Hedderberry, because he has lots and lots and lots of names. One of them, though, as it turned out, was Fernand Ramichel. And he had a driver's license, a Queensland driver's license, as it were, in that name. And police hadn't found that because they weren't looking for it because they didn't believe that she was a victim of anything. So we kind of forced them to believe that. And as a result, an inquest was triggered. And that meant that New South Wales Police had to launch their own investigation by the homicide squad. And they were the ones who found the link between like the fake Fernand Remicol and the real Fernand Remicol because of the Queensland driver's license. And also finding there was two things. It was that and also the ad that was in Le Courrier Australien and the phone number and the PO box being at Lennox Head. And yes, so they were able to discover this guy that was living there who was now going by the name Rick Blum, and then the fact that he had a driver's license before that was under the name Fernand Remicol. So, yes, very complicated, something that you could not even, you just would never dream of. You'd never be able to write a fiction story because you never would have thought of something no. so complicated.
Like it, yeah. you would be if you read that as a book, you'd be like, this is so far fetched. But it's just incredible the work that was done. I mean, this podcast, it's just like you've got over 50, 60 episodes, and you started out, I suppose, kind of looking to delve into this mystery and the story, not only because it's an incredibly interesting one and there's these little breadcrumbs that go along, but also Sally, Marion's daughter, was a huge part of this. You were working with her for it.
Yeah, I mean, she wanted our help, so that's what we did. And as a result, it was hard because you got to manage expectations, right? And justice, the wheels of justice turn very slowly, so everything was happening in real time. And so a lot of people who tune into podcasts, they expect it to be over in 12 episodes or 20 episodes or whatever, but they don't expect it to go on for 5 years and, you know, yeah, go through all the process there. So that was also very different. But also, you know, I had to, the momentum would go, but it would ebb and flow. So I would have to convince my bosses to stick with it and say, look, this is still really good, you know. Like, all right, that hasn't been anything for a while, but, you know, we've got to keep going. We've got to keep. And they ended up funding, you know, because Sally obviously hadn't gone through this process. It was all very daunting to her. She needed this assistance from us. So we paid for the trip to Europe, and then we paid for her legals as well because first of all, sorry, I go back one step. We had to get the file from New South Wales Police, who wouldn't give it to us, saying that suddenly it was still under investigation. And this is back before the inquest was triggered. So we ended up having to fight through the New South Wales Civil and Administrative Tribunal for it under Freedom of Information, or in New South Wales, it's called the GIPRAC. And that's what I specialise in. So I went through all that and I helped with, you know, I basically facilitated the external review. And then when New South Wales Police still wouldn't give it to us, we had to go to the Civil and Administrative Tribunal to fight for it, which gave us an unredacted, much less redacted version of the police file into Marion Barter. We'll be able to expose a lot of things, which was ultimately what shamed them into recognition and triggered the coroner's inquest. So that first step. But then obviously there's expectation that we continue with the legal support for Sally through the inquest. And yeah, and then that was, so it was always trying to negotiate and tell my bosses, yes, no, this is really good. And you know, because of the ebb and flow and because it was played in real time, it had peaks and troughs of popularity. So I would have to, you know, justify, as I said, the expense to say that we've got to see this through to the end.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. And tell us a little bit about that as well. The investigation, Sally really needed your help because from the get-go, the police were not listening to Sally when she said, my mother is missing. They were kind of telling her a couple of times, you know, she's alive and well, but that wasn't true.
That's true. I mean, they just came up with this. The problem is they didn't follow protocol, and that's what the inquest found as well. They didn't follow protocol of a missing person, which was that they must cite that missing person. They cited some phone call, apparently, that had been had, or it was all very murky, actually, as we went back in it. Then there was, it was like one, a Queensland police officer said that they heard from security or something like that. Anyway, it ended up being this whole big mishmash. Nobody could actually remember. There were notes saying that this was the case, but there was just no justification. Nobody had cited her. There was allegations perhaps that they spoke to her, but that she wanted to be left alone. But again, it wasn't verified. The identity wasn't verified and they messed up. And so that was against police protocol. So that came very early on. And even though New South Wales Police during the inquest would defend their officers all the way, there was acknowledgement from the new regime, because the during our investigation, they did get rid of the old missing persons unit and bring in a new missing persons unit. Mm-hmm. And the head of that protocol wasn't followed and they messed up. So, yeah, they seem to rectify that situation, though, once the inquest with the new homicide squad team doing an investigation.
So when the inquest began, it kind of stopped and restarted. When the inquest began, there was this certain information. They'd established a couple of facts. Marion had gone abroad. She came back in under this new name. She'd changed her name by Deepol. She had sold her house. There was all these things that they were able to confirm. But there's this incredible part of the podcast where it's the cliffhanger. It's the what's going to happen now, where Sally has told you there's something going to happen. She couldn't tell you what was happening. And then the inquest resumes with this bombshell.
Yeah, so when we were, I actually knew, because I'd rang in to a phone call. They have, you know, it could ring in sometimes as a party of interest or interested party. And it was, I rang in before the proceedings and I heard that there was a new lawyer involved and they were representing Mr. Blunt. That's all I knew. Now, obviously they couldn't tell me, but even if they did tell me or anyone told me or I found out or I did my own digging and found this Mr. Blum, I wouldn't have reported it, you know, it wouldn't have undermined legal proceedings. So I didn't do that. But I did know that there was obviously a person of interest, mm-hmm. but I had no idea how much of a person of interest it was. Like when those bombshells broke, there was like three big ones, our minds were blown. Like we, you know, all of a sudden, because the whole time we were, the real Fernand Remekel had never come to Australia. So we're kind of sitting there going, oh man, you know, how could this, none of it makes sense. So we had no idea that this was a case of stolen identity. And that was just like, we were just amazed. It was just amazing. Like when all that came, we were just out of our skins with excitement.
Yeah, because you're coming to this as not only as a journalist, as a producer of the podcast, but also as somebody who's been kind of going along this journey with Sally, who is so, so close to the story. Like she is part of it and part of what's happening. What was kind of that like for you to kind of have those bombshells revealed? And mostly, I would say, was Rick Blum found because of the piece of information that you got from the sleuth?
Well, it was a whole bunch of pieces of information. That information alone wasn't enough. You know, like what was enough was that ad combined with us finding the real Fernand Remekel, combined with police then linking the two men. That there was three, I guess, big components of that puzzle that needed to fit together. And so it was all, it's always been a team effort, you know, all of it. And we haven't been privy to the brief of evidence. Sally and that same super sleuth, Joni, who she sort of brought into it, she got permission so that she could be part of that. And so she was also privy to the brief of evidence, but we weren't. It was those three components which led to us discovering. And so none of us could have done it without each other, you know, the media aspect, the police aspect, and obviously the super sleuth, you know, and Sally's determination. So that it's never been just one one person driving this. And we've always remembered that. And we've always, always attributed everything, because obviously when you have something as big as this evolve, it's like that whole success has many fathers, failures an orphan sort of thing. So everyone's just like, well, it's me, or me, it's all me. But the reality is it's a team effort. You just couldn't have done, none of us could have gotten anywhere without the community, without the police. The police still did do something. They did do some work, and good work, and authorities, you know, the coroner, if the coroner hadn't, you know, called the inquest, because that forced so many things as well and information to come forward. And we got so many tip-offs from various people. So all those little incremental pieces of information as well. So it's just, you need that. You need to be able to draw on every aspect of, you know, the case and the people that know the people involved and knew Marion and, you know, triggered memories and, you know, so as a result, the inquest would stop and start because we would find another victim of this man who we discovered through the inquest. So that was also another thing. We'd, you know, they'd reach out to us, and then we'd do an interview with them, and then obviously a few of them came about because police found them, because they had already reported this romance fraud. So so it was a combination of things, and it turned out it wasn't just in Australia, but in Luxembourg, Belgium, and and the UK, I'd imagine, you know, in you know, although one of, you know, it involved the UK, I suppose one of the victims we don't know of having come or been in the UK at the time, but certainly one of them came from the UK.
So Marion was actually as well. She was in Tunbridge Wells in the UK at one point, because she had been sending postcards back home. But let's talk a little bit about the inquest. You know, it came to a conclusion. Obviously, it said the coroner gave their opinion on what had happened and did say, you know, they couldn't recommend criminal proceedings, but they just gave a conclusion of what happened to Marion, or what they believe happened to Marion, from all the evidence and all those different strands.
So, yeah, I mean, the coroner was stronger than we thought she would be, actually. I mean, she could have been stronger too, though, don't get me wrong. I mean, but as she pointed out, she gave a bit of a disclaimer. It's not her job. It's not punitive the way you have the same system, right, with coroners in the UK. So you understand how it works. But, yeah, she really wanted to, you know, I guess give her opinion on what she thought of the evidence being brought before her, which I thought was really strong. She made it very clear that she did not believe the evidence put forward by Rick Blum. And we have put in the podcast and in articles and everything else that he did lie, because it is obvious, it's evident in that that happened. And then she also gave a lot of weight. In fact, she made it very clear that she completely believed the women, the other victims who presented their information involving this man, that this had actually occurred. So, but at the same time, there's no punishment for that. Even though that is the opinion that they were defrauded by him, there was there was another woman who didn't want to be named, who lost $100,000, and then Jeanette Gaffney Bowen, you know, she lost her dignity as well as money as well, and then the other one being Janet Oldberg, who, you know, almost lost, or she lost the deeds to a house, but then she got it back. So they always said that she got off quite easy. But, you know, it's been actually Ghislaine as well. Ghislaine was the one who probably had the hardest time of it, because she really loved him, you know, like she really felt, and I guess from our point of view, it seems that Marion did too. You know, Marion swallowed the whole story. And not only that, she gave everything. She did everything he wanted. None of them sold their houses and gave him the money. Ghislaine sold a house but didn't give him the money. But Marion, and so it all calls into question what happened when she actually confronted him about this and, you know, discovered the truth. So that is unfortunately still a mystery. So we haven't got the complete conclusion, but we certainly have a much better idea of what happened.
Mm. And do you believe that Marion eventually found out what was going on?
Yes, absolutely I do. Yeah, I mean, my belief is that that did happen, and that she would have been quite devastated. I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to Laura Richards. We've certainly had her in our podcast. She's given her theories. I think that her theories are very sound, and I can understand because she's a criminal behavioral analyst as well. So that's her expertise. So it's not just someone just giving their opinion like me as a journalist who isn't educated in this area. And so she's been really good, I think. And I do think that there's a lot to be said for what she said. And she goes further than, say, a coroner can go. But, you know, I guess the question is whether police are going to investigate further. And there is an idea that unless something's dropped in their lap, that they're not actually going to chase it themselves because they've got so many competing priorities.
Mm. And what did Rick Blum have to say for himself? I mean, he was on the stand at the inquest.
Well, he belittled everybody else, basically. All the women he was very critical of in a way that demeaned them, including Marion. And he basically called them all liars, even though it was clear that they had nothing to gain except embarrassment from coming forward. They weren't going to get anything back. They weren't going to get justice, except potentially that he might be seen for what he did, and there might be justice in another capacity, even if it's perjury, which it doesn't seem like they're going to pursue. So that was something that we hoped would happen. But he would basically tell them all that they were crazy, stupid sluts. You know, like he would be so that they would. That was the sort of way he put them. That was a category he would put them into. It was, and it's something that I have looked at a lot with narcissistic behaviour. It's, you know, I guess we've always come. I've come across a person in my life where they just completely. Just denied everything, even though all the evidence was there. It was just crazy. I don't understand that, but it was very much like that. And I don't think in some people they have the capacity to tell the truth. Mm. So that's basically, I think there are other people who know the truth, but I don't know if they will ever speak it either, at least not while he's alive.
Mm. And I suppose before we go, how is Sally? How did that all affect her? How is she doing now? She obviously maybe not complete closure with the inquest, as in she hasn't got her mother's remains if she's passed away, but hopefully some closure in the sense that, you know, she doesn't have to live with this kind of ambiguous loss anymore.
Well, I think she says that closure, I don't think she'll ever really have closure. I think she looks still a bit angry out of what had happened and if this was treated properly in the first place, that she may have all the answers she wants and may have found out where her mother's remains are. So I think there is always going to be that. I mean, obviously she's grateful, but it's taken a personal toll, as you can imagine. It's taken a personal toll on everyone involved in different ways because it is stressful and it can be quite challenging to navigate through all the things that come up and the issues, and it's you know, managing expectations and being there, you know, delivering everything for everyone and trying to keep everyone happy. That's always really hard too. But I think Sally is just grateful that she's gotten this far. She's still got plenty of other frustrations ahead. I know she's having trouble getting the death certificate because of the dual names, like she wants both names on and that is proving problematic. Her and Joni planning a trip themselves to, you know, because they have the brief of evidence, which is still under lock and key, they have a few more bits of information that they can follow up with the death certificate, because have any faith that New South Wales Police will do any more investigation. So what is required is new information coming forward. And, of course, we've written a book, which is a condensed version of The Lady Vanishes, because it's 57 episodes. It's a lot to go through, right? And because it is in real time, there's a lot of, I guess, you know, stuff that we can cut that would just get to the essence of it, and hopefully that will reach more people, and maybe people who don't listen to podcasts or have seen it in the newspaper or on television can come forward and bring new information as well. So it's all those aspects of it that that we're just trying to keep that going, keep that momentum, that we will finally ultimately get the final details that we need, because I know Sally would really like that, and that would truly make her happy. And I think as we've seen beginning, she's relentless. She's not going to give up.
Absolutely.
She needs to keep going. And this is something that she wanted to, the next chapter she wanted to do alone, and that was fine. We were happy from that perspective to let her do that. And then maybe one day there might be a Lady Vanishes trial, if we can get that extra information to make a prosecution happen.
Absolutely. And when is the book coming out? Do you have a date for that yet?
Yes, that's mid-May. Send me your details and I'll send you a copy.
I'd love that.
Now, I have to say, I'm so sorry, and I haven't said your name because I'm so afraid of mispronouncing it, and because I've been so busy. Can you tell me how to...
Yes, it's Clodagh. So the GH at the end is silent.
Clodagh, thank goodness. That's all right. So sorry. I just wouldn't say it just because I thought I'm really going to embarrass myself here. I do love Ireland. I love it so much. I have been over there, and my I know a lot about it. It's just such a beautiful country. But yes, so I will send that to you. And yeah, if I can get an advanced copy, I'll do that too. But yeah, send me your details. Send me your address.
Thank you. Well, look, our listeners will have to go and listen to The Lady Vanishes. Like you said, there's over 50 episodes there, and we have barely even touched the tip of the iceberg. So, Alison, Sandy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Clodagh.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com, produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Clodagh Meaney. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review, or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.